Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we welcome to the microphone Patty Nagai of Sturtevant, Wisconsin, horticulture educator for Racine County, UW Extension. Really happy to have her with us by telephone today. And certainly if you have some questions about what's going on in your lawn or your garden, why, you are welcome to join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. We'll get you on the air pretty quickly. Patty Nagai, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be back on the show with you.
Yes, and you are home with the twins.
I am.
How old are they now?
They're 8 months old.
Oh, my gosh.
And I did call in for backup, so my mom has come over to, in case they wake up from their nap.
I wondered how we were going to handle that today.
Well, they would just talk and answer all of the questions also. They're very, very advanced.
Now, what do you have? Boy, girl, two girls, two boys?
One of each.
One of each.
One of each, Jack and Isabel, and they are a joy. And I think they are very much looking forward to this nice weather, too, so that they can get outside.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's going to be a little harder for you getting outside and getting some work done with the twins, or do you just take them along with
you? I'm going to take them along with me and put them to work.
Why not? It's never too early.
No, they can just learn by watching for the first couple of years. But my other daughter is 7 years old, and she loves to garden. She's a big help. So, it's really never too early to get kids out in the garden. It's a wonderful experience for them.
Well, I agree wholeheartedly. Emily, who is 3 and a half now, has been spending time out there, out in the lawn and the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Since we could get her out there, you know. Yep. We had her out there too when she was, before she could walk around.
Yep, they learn a lot even just by watching.
Well, I tell you what, every line's full, so let's go to the phones.
Okay.
Judy and Ripon, it's your turn. Hi, Judy, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if your desk could comment on people who live in rural areas that would like to plant annuals and have a problem with deer in their yard.
Oh.
I know that there's some perennials that they'll stay away from, and I don't even have a complete list of those yet, but do you have a reference or a guidebook? I love annuals. I love to plant petunias and zinnias and all those things.
Yeah,
and the deer are just going to destroy them.
It's really a tough thing to garden when you have an abundance of deer around. And even in, you know, the Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee area, which is highly urban, we have a lot of deer issues as well. In fact, I had someone in my office just yesterday asking me about the deer eating everything, and he lives in a very populated area. But there are pockets of deer everywhere, and they, of course, you know, they get pushed out of their natural environment, and they get really hungry. And, you know, the thing about deer is that they will eat almost anything. And if they're hungry, they really will eat anything, even things that are on the deer don't eat list. And we do have a deer don't eat list. It is on our publications website, learningstore.uwex.edu. It is a publication called Plants That Deer Don't Eat.
Okay.
So pretty easy to find. You could probably even Google it and find that list. It's mostly woody plants on the list, but there's some herbaceous things on there as well. But no list is foolproof because deer, like I said, deer, if they're hungry enough, they will eat almost anything.
Will it help if I feed them? If I put food on the edge of the woods, would it keep them away?
No, don't feed the deer.
No.
That just encourages them.
It may even be illegal where you live.
Oh, okay. Yeah, in most areas. It is down in our area. You're not supposed to feed the deer anymore. It's just too risky for a number of reasons. You know, the spread of chronic wasting disease, but also the spread of the Lyme disease through the deer tick.
Okay, I thought maybe if I filled them up, they wouldn't be so hungry for my flowers.
No, you'll just get more of them.
You'll just get more. You just encourage more and more of them to come. Hey, this is a great place for dinner. Come on over. You know, they tell all your friends about it. But one of the things that I've read about lately that I think is really interesting is, you know, many people have suggested all different types of deer repellents, and for the most part, deer repellents don't work for the long term. You know, they might work once, and then they get used to it, and they come back. And so you can try lots and lots of different things, like the coyote urine or the lion urine or all of these different products. But there is some new research going on using milorganite, which
is a
sewage sludge fertilizer, a natural fertilizer. But there's some suggestion from this new research that milorganite actually does deter deer.
Oh, my. Good. And I have some of that in my garage. I'll
so,
put it out.
You know, it's definitely worth a try. I would suggest looking at the list, too, and seeing if there's some plants on there that you might, you know, want to try. But I would try the milorganite and just, you know, keep your fingers crossed. You know, in the nursery industry and in the fruit crop industry, the only thing that really works is a 10-foot high fence.
Yep.
Okay. You know, so, and most people aren't willing or able to do that around their property. But deer are just so persistent.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you.
So,
thanks,
good
Judy.
Luck.
Good luck, Judy. Thank you. John and Gordon, we'll turn to you now. Hi, John.
For the last caller, I just wanted to let her know the best deer repellent that I have found is a Jack Russell Terrier.
Yeah.
If I get a deer in the yard, that dog is in the window.
Yeah. I should have mentioned that because I've had people tell me that, too, that they didn't have deer problems for a long time, and now they have lost their dog, and now they have deer problems.
Yeah.
You know,
the barking in the window seems
yeah.
to just kind of drive them out of the yard anyway.
Dogs, even a smaller dog, will really do a lot to repel deer. They don't care for dogs.
And they won't, and the little dogs won't chase them. They'll
yeah.
the woods.
They just bark a lot.
I was wondering, I'm up here, of course, I came from Burlington, Wisconsin, which is down there in
Racine County. Yes, it is.
And I've noticed with the sandy soils up here, where would I take my dirt to get the pH tested?
Well, you know, Madison has a soil testing lab that we send soil samples from all over the state into the Madison lab at Verona, and I don't know that address right off the top of my head, but it's easily available off of the UW Extension website. You can just do a search for Wisconsin Soil Testing Lab. There are also a lot of private soil testing labs that can do that for you.
Okay.
But the university lab, you can just mail the sample in, and you can pick the soil testing kit up at any of your extension, at your local extension office. They should have the soil bags, the form, and all the information on how to send the sample in.
It costs
$15, and you'll get a complete analysis.
Okay. I do some water testing for pH and iron and things like that. There's not a self-kit available, is there?
There are many, many different levels of soil testing kits available for the homeowner.
Okay.
You can get simple little pH strips that are very inexpensive, and you can get pH probes that are quite expensive. But they are not going to be as accurate as having it tested in a lab that does, you know, hundreds and hundreds of samples every day. And one of the problems with the home pH kits is that most of the time I find that they don't come with any kind of standardization. And so it might tell you you have a pH of 5.2, but you don't really have a standard to test your kit with to see whether or not 5.2 is really 5.2. So in the laboratory, when you're doing a pH sample, you have various standards. You test, you know, you test at pH 3, you test
calibrator.
At pH 4, right, and you make sure that whatever you're using is calibrated to the correct pH. And the home kits, the ones that I've seen, don't come with that.
All
and
right.
so it's kind of an arbitrary number.
Yeah, and I should mention, too, there's a soil testing lab in Marshfield, Wisconsin, a little closer to you.
Oh, that's true. And that information is on the soil test kit. You can send it to either location. You can send it to the one in Verona or the one in Marshfield.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thanks for the question.
Thanks a lot for calling. And you can join in, too, on this edition of Garden Talk as we visit with Patty Nagai of Sturtevant, Wisconsin, horticulture educator for Racine County UW Extension. And the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison at 263-1890. Mike in Milwaukee, you are next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have recently bought a house that has a very large lot, and I backed up to one of the parks in Milwaukee that has a lot of deer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to try to battle the deer. That's not the reason, because I know they'll win.
Yes.
but my backyard is probably 200 to 250 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to maintain 200 to 250 feet deep of lawn. I want to let, you know, most of it return to the natural wooded setting.
Okay.
So the grass that I have back there, would it be best for me just to stop mowing, or should I just rototill it? What will enhance or speed up the natural process of having this return to woodland instead of having
Well, if you want it to be a woodland area, of course, the key piece in that is the woods. You need to make sure that you've got trees and shrubs planted. And if you really want it to be a native area, look at the native plant lists and determine what grouping, what community of plants you want to establish there. Some of that could be determined by the soil type that you have. And so, you know, not just look around and see what's nearby, because some of that may have been planted artificially, you know, and not a natural plant for your area. But if you have an idea of what your soil is like, you can then kind of start putting together a list of trees and understory type shrubs that would be great for that area. You don't necessarily have to do anything with the grass. And there are a lot of different ways to do this. Some people would go in and, you know, kill everything and start from scratch and replant and do all of that. But the truth is that once the trees and shrubs start to grow, and if you really want it to get naturalized, and you're not doing any kind of, you know, cutting or maintaining in there, eventually that grass is going to die out, because turf grass needs sun. And so as the sun declines, the grass will decline. And as your trees and shrubs mature and drop leaves, they're going to be dropping leaves on that grass. The grass is going to get smothered by those leaves, and you're going to end up with a nice organic layer underneath your trees and shrubs that actually is very good for your trees and shrubs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can do it in a very natural way and get your plants in there and just let it go. Or you can go in more aggressively and, you know, kill everything off. You can till it up and replant everything in a more organized fashion. It depends on, you know, how much time you want to spend on it and how much you mind that disorderly look that's going to exist during the naturalized process. You know, a lot of people would go in and kill off the grass and plant their trees and shrubs and then put a nice thick layer of mulch down. And then that way they don't worry about weeds coming up. They don't worry about grass coming back. They've got that mulch layer already established. But eventually that mulch layer will establish itself. But it's going to take a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Where can I go to take cuttings of the trees that are growing naturally in the woods now to have those identified? Because I have a lot of woodland, too, and I could just transplant some of the things that are naturally mm-hmm. occurring. I know some things along the border of my lot have been planted by humans, but in the back, it's all natural. So where can I go to get those things identified?
It might be natural, but it might not be native.
Because I live in Grant Park, so a lot of it is native, too.
Oh,
so
good. Okay.
I want to identify what's native there, and I don't want to go to a nursery and try planting things that might grow there. I want to use what is growing there natively.
Right. Well, I can tell you right now, Schlitz Audubon Center is doing a huge native plant sale, and so they have a lot of trees and shrubs that they are currently selling. I think today might actually be the last day to order, but they're going to have a lot of things on hand that they can sell, even for people who don't pre-order. But to get your plants identified, that is something that the UW Extension Plant Health Advisors will do for you. I believe in Milwaukee County they charge a fee to do plant identification, but they can certainly help you with that and are willing to spend the time with you to identify the plants that are in your yard. There are some great tree guides on the web through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website. So if you go to Wisconsin DNR, you can look for their tree identifier webpage, and you could try to learn how to identify those trees yourself, because it has mm-hmm. all of the native Wisconsin trees on there, identified by bark, bud, leaf shape, leaf color, and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And you could go to the Dane County Tree Board website, which is treeboard.org, and it also has information and a lot of other links, too.
All right, thank you.
Okay, I didn't know about that one, so that's good to know.
I'm on the tree board, so.
Oh, so you know these things.
Okay, and you could go to the...
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Don in Columbus, it's your turn. Thanks for calling. Well, hold on a second here. Let me just...
Did we lose Don?
No, we didn't. I just made a little mistake, which I am now going to rectify. There we go. Now we can get Don. Okay. Hi, Don. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Say, Larry, you mentioned blueberries at
yes.
the beginning of the show. I guess tell me about blueberries. I've About 10 years ago, planted about 10 blueberry plants, and I got 8 left, and, you know, they didn't really die, but they're not really doing anything.
Yeah, in Columbus, you're probably not, you may not have the acid soil conditions, but Patty, what about it?
Yeah, tell me, you know, I don't know, I heard today something about pine needles, and I know they grow well in Michigan in the sand, but...
Right. Well, there's,
so
they
just
have
tell me about it, I guess.
Really different soil in Michigan than they have here. It's really important for blueberries to be in acid soil, and that's the key thing. So if you haven't had your soil tested, it would be a good idea to go ahead and have it tested and check out the pH. Blueberries like a pH of, you know, 4, 4.5. I mean, they really like acidic. They can do okay in, like, 5.2, but just depending on where your land is, you know, your pH could be 7,
yeah.
Like it is down in Racine County.
Yeah, that's probably what it is in Columbus, or
yeah.
Could well be, anyway.
Yeah.
You can make your soil more acid.
Yeah,
you can. It's not an easy thing to do, and if you had them growing for that long, my guess is that your pH is on the slightly acidic side. In Racine, in most of the areas where people keep trying to grow blueberries and are not very successful, our pHs run about 7.2 to even as high as 8.4. They're really acidic.
Wow.
And so even using the acidifying sulfur-type compounds in the soil, blueberries typically don't last more than about 3 years. And what happens is the first year that you plant a blueberry in non-optimal soil conditions, it looks okay. And you might even get some flowers and fruit. And then the second year, depending on how bad your pH is, the second year you might get fewer flowers, fewer fruit, and you'll start to notice some yellowing of the foliage. By the third year, if your pH is really high, those plants could be dead because they just are not able to take up the nutrients they need in higher pH soils. So it's important to know what your pH is. If it is close to being the right pH, that is, if your pH is like 6 or, you know, 5.8 or something like that, it's not too difficult to get it down a full unit down to pH 5 or pH 4.8 using sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you do that is that you can dig the entire area up, and you need to dig it to a depth of about 3 feet in order to really do proper soil pH adjustment for blueberries. Mm-hmm. Dig it down and incorporate elemental sulfur. And that's just the yellow powder. You can get it at any garden center or farm supply store.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a pound per 100 square feet or something along those lines for the recommendation, more so if you have a higher pH. And you do that, and you incorporate things like peat moss, decomposed pine straw, things like that that would organically help to keep the pH a little bit lower. Plant your blueberries, and then every year you're going to have to do a further application of sulfur, not elemental sulfur, though. It would be either aluminum sulfate or iron sulfate.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, because it's really hard to change the pH of the soil because there's so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And as the plants grow, they're going to be growing out into the other areas of soil. And if you have a limestone base to your soil, if underneath you've got limestone that's bubbling up like it is in southeast Wisconsin, that limestone keeps bubbling up, and you keep adding sulfur, and the limestone keeps bubbling up trying to counteract your sulfur, and because the pH really wants to be what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So if your soil is naturally pH 7, it wants to be pH 7, and it's going to do everything it can to stay there.
Okay. So that Miracle-Gro, isn't that kind of an acid, or what is that actually?
Well, Miracle-Gro is a brand name for fertilizer, and they make lots and lots of different types of fertilizers.
Okay. So there is
there's a fertilizer that they make called Mir Acid.
Yeah, yeah.
And even under the Mir Acid name, they have many different types of fertilizers.
Okay.
So you have to read the label really carefully. But yes, Mir Acid does have an acidifier in it. But it's also a fertilizer, so you wouldn't want to use that constantly. And it would be quite expensive, too. And it helps with nutrient uptake for acid-loving plants like rhododendrons and azaleas and blueberries, but it's not going to solve your soil problem. To solve the problem, when you plant the plants, you need to incorporate peat moss and pine straw and that sort of thing. And then you also need to incorporate that sulfur compound.
Okay. Well, that's all doable for me. So.
All right.
But get your pH checked first, because
okay.
You need to know what you're starting with.
Yeah, and I guess, like I say, those that I planted a long time ago, they're all still healthy. I mean, they don't turn yellow or anything, but they just don't grow. They're only a foot or two high.
Yeah, you know, yeah. My guess is that your pH is probably on the acidic side, but not quite acidic enough. You know, it's acidic enough for them to take up just barely enough nutrients.
Okay.
So get that soil tested, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Yep, thanks, Don. Gary in Chicago, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I've got another deer repellent thing that I've used personally on some plantings of trees.
Mm-hmm.
It works real well. It was developed by Weyerhaeuser out in the West Coast for their conifer or nurseries.
Mm-hmm. What is it?
It's basically a rotten egg.
Oh.
Yeah.
The sulfur compounds, yeah.
Well, what it is the they developed a big game repellent out of a company in Minnesota, actually, and it was basically rotten egg solids with a spreader sticker. But if you've ever tried to clean egg off a plate, you really don't need a spreader sticker on that stuff.
No, it's pretty potent by itself, yes.
Right, and the problem is it only lasts a few months. So what I do is I put it on the leaders of the white pine that are still in the browse zone in the fall, just before all the other greenery disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And then again in the spring, just before everything greens up, because that's the time that things are most heavily browsed.
Yeah, and it's a stinky process.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You can't let it ferment too much or it turns into a custard type.
Yeah, and I have heard success on a lot of different types of deer repellents for a while. You know, they work for a while. And I think a couple of different things happen. I think one is that people get tired of putting them on. You know, so they stop,
yeah,
and then the plants become vulnerable again. But I think the other thing is that the deer do get used to certain repellents, and, you know, after a while, they're hungry enough that it doesn't matter what it is. They're just going to eat it anyway.
Thanks, Gary.
Right.
Yeah. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for the suggestion.
And if you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller with Patty Nagai, who is horticulture educator for Racine County UW Extension, Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller with my guest, Patty Nagai. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question. And Audrey in Shorewood has a question for us. Hi, Audrey. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I have a summer sweet. It's a bush, and I've had it for years, and it's been doing well. Now, this winter, the rabbits had a ball over there. They have taken off all the branches. It looks as if I pruned it, which I never do. And I'm wondering if it's going to come back or not.
Boy.
It probably will. You know, there are two little critters that do a lot of damage to a number of different shrubs and vines in the winter that can do some not helpful pruning and sometimes kill shrubs. And rabbits are one. And the other one is...
Well, they left their calling cards, so I'm sure,
sure it's
rabbits.
Right. The other one is voles. And voles are, you know, the little meadow mice. And they're actually worse because usually when they go after a shrub, they go right at the soil line and girdle it.
No, this is up above. It looks as if I pruned it.
Right. And you know what I would do is I would do some careful pruning to shape
it
up.
It's all pruned already.
Oh, they didn't leave anything for you?
I can't do anymore.
Well, then the answer is really simple. Wait and see.
Yeah.
They
bloom. I mean, they start leafing out rather late, don't they?
Yes, they are a little bit late to leaf out, so I would wait and see. Chances are you are going to get some new growth coming out from the base of the plant.
Oh.
Just as if you had pruned it back yourself.
Oh.
The branches
that are left, they won't leaf out?
They might. It depends on how much damage there is to them. But more likely, you know, when we prune, we actually are stimulating growth. And so when you make a pruning cut, it stops the elongation of that branch because you've cut it off. But what it does is stimulate any buds below to branch.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes with the pruning, you get more growth from the base of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
If it is cut back too far, with some plants, you might not have enough buds to come back out.
Mm.
But if you've got any buds at all down there at the base of the plant, what you're going to find is, you know, each branch is probably going to shoot out two or three branches.
I don't see any buds on the branches.
Yeah. Well, wait and see. Don't give
up
on it yet because it may surprise you. There are also there are a lot of shrubs that will they'll branch out from seemingly below the ground. You know, lilacs will do that. Forsythia, a lot of different shrubs will send up new shoots from under the soil. So you don't even see where those buds are because they're actually under the ground. So don't give up on it yet. But you might want to start looking at new shrubs that you might want to replace.
And some fencing for around the shrubs.
Right. And, you know, rabbits, deer are more difficult. But rabbits, you actually can protect your shrubs in the fall if you make a little fence of hardware cloth, which is not chicken wire. It's the
screen,
quarter-inch metal screen. You can find it at any hardware store, garden center. They all sell hardware cloth. And you just need to make sure it comes up at least 18, 24 inches off the ground. And that will keep the rabbits from destroying your shrub.
Good luck, Audrey. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. Gail in Wauwatosa, it's your turn. Hi, Gail.
Hello. My question is in regards to transplanting strawberry plants. I currently have them in a retaining wall. Because when I planted them 2 years ago, I wanted them to get a good start, and we didn't have the garden dug yet. And
okay.
This year, I would like to transplant them because the garden area will provide a lot more sunlight than they've had, and
right.
They have not produced hardly any berries.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming a lot has to do with where they've been.
Right. They need a lot of sunlight.
Yeah. When should I do that? And
I would do it now.
Okay.
I would do it now. The sunlight is a critical factor, of course, so make sure that you've got an area in your yard that's already prepared and ready to go.
There,
we have an excellent publication on strawberries that'll give you some ideas about how to plant them and how to prepare the soil at our publications website. But make sure that you've got the site ready to go. Go ahead and transplant them. And I know it's a little bit late, but it's better now than letting them go another year in a spot that's not good.
Yep.
Yeah.
So go
ahead
and get them in the ground. And you might get some flowers and fruit this year, but I would suggest that you remove those and wait until next year to harvest. And you will have a much healthier plant and a much healthier establishment of the plants.
Mm-hmm.
Should I cut all the previous vines off from last year, kind of trim it back when I transplant?
Well, those vines are the baby plants.
Okay.
So
that's what I figured, but I just wanted to make sure.
It depends on whether or not you want your bed to enlarge. I would say you could go ahead and plant the little runners and let those plants develop, too, and just plan that out when you're establishing your bed.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call for you to join in. Ron and Abrams, it's your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hello. I've been trying to find the time when I could get hold of you when you're on about deer repellents. For years, I've used human hair.
Oh, okay.
When I go get a haircut, I ask them for a bag of hair, and I stuff an old sock with it, and I have it on my fruit trees out in back. And I just hang a sock on the fruit trees.
I have heard from many people that is quite successful as long as you keep replacing it, because the scent does dissipate after a while. And that can be a repellent that works also, as long as you're consistent about it. And it sounds like you are, so that's a good idea.
Yeah, and, you know, you got to get a haircut every, 6 weeks or so anyway, so just grab another big batch of hair when you're there.
Collect hair from your neighbors.
Well, you just get it at the barber shop. They usually,
my
barber always has plenty of hair around. No problem there.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ron. Appreciate it. Dale in River Falls, your turn. Hi, Dale.
Hi there.
What can we do for
you?
Great. What can we do for you?
I've got out the backside of my house, there's a hillside, and I've got a beautiful, gnarly old oak tree in that hillside that I hang a couple of bird feeders from year-round. And underneath the oak tree, I get a fairly substantial amount of bird seed residue that turns into plants in the spring and summer. And I'm wondering what I can do to knock down those those plants without hurting the oak tree.
Buy a different type of bird seed.
Yeah.
Seriously, there are a lot of higher quality bird seed mixtures that won't germinate. And so even if they lose the seed down on the ground, it won't germinate. Typically, the ones that I've seen that have the most problem with this are the bird seed mixtures that have a lot of millet in them. Because the millet is, you know, just, it's a filler seed, and it's very rarely heat-treated, and so it all germinates just crazy, and so you get this really weedy-looking grass coming up.
Will the bird seed sellers know
what I'm
talking about?
Oh, yes. And you'll pay a little more. But
It'll be a little bit more expensive, but I think it's worth it.
Because, oh, yeah, I do, too.
When you buy untreated seed, when you buy the seed that is you know, will germinate, you end up with all sorts of weird stuff coming up all around your yard because
yes,
the birds will take it and drop it around.
That's
right. So then you get weeds everywhere.
Right.
And you really don't want millet in your yard. I don't think you do anyway.
You've answered my question. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Sally in Milwaukee, you are next. Hi, Sally.
Oh, hi. I have some arborvitae bushes, and I was wondering if I could trim them now.
I wouldn't. Why do you want to trim them, though? Let me ask you that.
I beg your pardon?
Why do you want to trim them?
Well, because they need trimming, you know.
Are they too close to the house? Are they?
Well, they are close to the house, yes.
Are these older shrubs?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Typically, for evergreens, and the reason I asked you about why you wanted to trim them is that typically with evergreens, we don't recommend trimming. You know, most evergreens do quite well on their own, and they develop a nice shape, and, you know, if they're planted in the right location, they should not need to be pruned, unless you're growing Christmas trees, you know, and that, you know, Christmas trees are always pruned, so...
Well, these are rather low.
Are they the globe-type arborvitae, the round ones?
Yeah, the ball type.
Right. You know, again, if they're planted in the right location, they really shouldn't need to be trimmed.
Mine do.
Yeah.
You can do it.
I'm not telling you can't. We just generally don't recommend it because, you know, evergreens develop a nice shape on their own. Arborvitae is one of the evergreen shrubs that will branch out very prolifically. Usually they are okay to prune in the spring because they will send out new branches. There are some evergreens that you really should not prune because they will not branch back out. And so pruning could be very detrimental to them. But arborvitae are pretty good about it. So you can start pruning. I wouldn't do it now. I would wait another few weeks before I would start doing it.
Oh, you would, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because now they already have like little berries on them, you know.
Right, but what you really want to wait for is the new growth. You want to wait to prune until you're actually seeing some new growth come out.
All right.
Okay.
Good luck, Sally. Thank you very much for calling. And on to Renee in East Troy. Hi, Renee.
Hi, I'm actually calling for a friend. I took care of, my mom had a gorgeous wisteria vine. She lived on the east side of Milwaukee, and she recently passed away, so I just pruned her wisteria vine for a couple of years while she was sick. But I knew from what she told me how to keep it blooming. But I have a friend who saw photos of this vine, and she said, "My gosh, my vine has never bloomed. It's evidently really long and lanky." And is there any hope for an older wisteria vine that's never bloomed? What would you recommend?
I would recommend buying a new one.
Yeah.
Really?
And the reason is that there are several different kinds of wisteria, and they all look fairly similar. You know, their actual blooms will be different, but if it's never bloomed, you don't know what the bloom looks like. But there's a Chinese, a Japanese, and a Kentucky or a Native American wisteria. And in our area, all three of them will grow, but not all three of them will flower. And even within the types, so within the Kentucky type, within the Japanese type, within the Chinese type, there are different cultivars, some of which are better suited for our area than others. And so a lot of people have planted, especially the Chinese wisteria, because it is very vigorous, and it's really not suitable for our area for flowers. It's suitable for our area for growth, and it'll get so big and so heavy that it can actually bring down trellises. You know, it can tear up structures, it can cover trees and kill them. I mean, it can be very aggressive, but it might not ever flower because we just don't have the right spring conditions for it to set flower buds.
Can you recommend a wisteria that might work?
The Kentucky wisterias are better suited for Wisconsin, and this is for southern Wisconsin. I don't know how far north you can go with the Kentucky wisteria, but there are some newer varieties out. There's one called, I believe it's Blue Moon, that's absolutely beautiful and completely hardy. It's hardy to like zone 3, and that would cover part of northern Wisconsin. So definitely okay for the Milwaukee or the Walworth County area.
Okay.
Look at a reputable nursery that's selling wisteria, and look for some of the Kentucky types of wisterias,
and you
will be better off.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. If you'd like to join in, we've got open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly here as we visit with Patty. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking all things gardening here on Garden Talk, Larry Mueller with my guest Patty Nagai, horticulture educator for Racine County UW Extension. You know, Patty, I took a quick look in the Jung's catalog on the Blue Moon Wisteria. It does. It's a pretty flower, and they say it's good to minus 40.
Oh, wow. It's even hardier than I thought.
So,
yeah. But, you know, you have to be careful about hardiness indexes when it comes to flowering plants.
Yeah.
Because, you know, forsythia is a good example of that, because we have a lot of varieties that are hardy here, but the flower buds aren't hardy.
Yeah.
And so, sure, the shrub is hardy to minus 20 or minus 30, but you won't get any flowers.
Oh.
And so wisteria is kind of the same way, because we grow wisteria for the beautiful flowers.
Yeah.
And people are so often disappointed because many nurseries will sell the other varieties, the other types of wisteria that are not truly hardy here. And the plants are hardy. The plants will be rated at zone 5 or zone 4, but the flower buds are not hardy.
Okay.
So you have to be a little bit cautious about that. But there are a lot of different cultivars of Kentucky wisteria that are suitable for our area, and they're beautiful.
Let's take another call. Carol in Wisconsin Rapids, your turn now. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have a question about starting a small tall grass prairie area in our backyard. We have a retaining wall that goes about 40 or 50 feet across the backyard, and I'd like to put prairie grass above it and below it.
Okay.
I know this isn't something I can do overnight.
That's good that you're aware of that ahead of time.
Yeah, if you could explain something about how to do it and maybe some publications, I can take answer off the air.
Okay.
Okay. Thank
we'll
you.
That. Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. And we get a lot of questions about starting prairies in different areas of people's yards. And I think it's a great thing to do if you've got the right space for it. There are a lot of very good publications for starting a prairie. I just received a new one from UW-Madison called Prairie Plants, and it's published from the UW Press by Theodore Cochrane, C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E, a really great book with a lot of information, and so that might be a helpful starting place. But UW Extension also has a prairie primer on the website, the learningstore.uwex.edu, if you type in prairie primer, you can actually download that for free, and it gives you a starting point for how to establish a prairie in your yard. As far as plants go, usually when we talk about a prairie, especially a native sun prairie, we are looking at a lot of grasses versus forbs, and forbs are what we term the flowering plants, the coneflowers and the blazing stars and that sort of
sure.
thing. And depending on what kind of look you want, you can adjust the mixture, but it's unusual to have just forbs or just grasses. And so what I would recommend is reading the information pretty carefully and then deciding, you know, which plants you want. Grasses are a staple, though, of the prairie because the grasses provide the bones, the structure, and they serve a purpose in helping to hold up the other forbs, the flowering plants. And so you can have 70% grasses and 30% forbs, and you'll get a nice mixture of color and then the nice texture of the grass and the winter support for the plants. And it will attract a lot of wildlife, a lot of birds, and it's a beautiful thing to do in your yard. The blue-stem grasses, there are some prairie drop seed grasses, Indian grass, lots of different grasses that you can use. Typically in a prairie, you'll have anywhere from 2 to 5 species of grasses, but lots of grass. And then maybe up to 20 species of forbs, the flowering plants, but only 30% of your total plants would be the flowering plants. And with that mixture, you get beautiful interest from spring all the way through winter.
Yeah, it's nice winter interest, too, which is a real advantage as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
Barb in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Barb.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a quite old lilac bush that needs some trimming. Mm-hmm. And I'm just not sure when I should do it. It does not flower a lot. It does flower, but not real thick.
Okay.
And then I also have a question about the little shoots that come up underneath mm-hmm. and how to transplant those.
Okay. Well, those little shoots are your future flowering shrub.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that you actually should be encouraging to grow.
You ought to be hacking those other ones off at the base.
Yeah, and you know, I have this picture in my head because I've seen this in so many different places where people have older lilac bushes that they have very carefully pruned so that they only have like 3 or 5 trunks down at the bottom, and then it's, you know, 15 feet tall. And then they're confused because they've got this nice-looking short tree, tall shrub that doesn't flower anymore. And lilac is one of those shrubs that really flowers better on newer wood. And so by pruning out the new growth and leaving the old growth, you're encouraging a lot of woody growth but discouraging flowers. So the way to actually prune a lilac is in the spring after flowering, you prune back the oldest wood. So the biggest branches, the ones that are the thickest, are the ones that you cut all the way down to the ground, and I mean to the ground, level with the soil. And what that does is stimulate new shoots coming up from the root system and the base or the crown of the plant. Those new shoots are the ones that will develop flower buds for next year. So, you know, lilac does make flowers on previous year's wood, but it prefers newer wood to make those flowers. So there are different pruning methods that you can use to accomplish this, but a lot of times with really old shrubs that have these only 3 or 5 humongous trunks that might be, you know, 5 inches in diameter, a lot of times they won't break. The buds won't break, and you cut them back, and they don't send up new shoots. But it sounds like she's getting really good shoot growth coming up, so
right.
There's still hope for this one. But it's a challenge for a lot of people to look at that shrub and then cut it back the way it needs to be cut back because it's pretty drastic. But if you want to rejuvenate it and you want to get new flowers, you've got to cut back that older growth. And we do have some great fact sheets on pruning deciduous trees and pruning deciduous shrubs that will explain and give nice line pictures on how to do it. And that's on our Wisconsin Horticulture website under Garden Facts.
Thank you. And the question that I have about some of the newer shoots,
mm-hmm.
some of them are coming up way out into my lawn, and they're the ones that I would like to...
Oh, if you want to try and dig them up, you can try. But you have to realize that they're attached to a really big root system, and so they're probably not going to like being transplanted. And when you dig them up, you're going to be messing around with the root system on the main plant. Okay.
So actually, I would be better off just to leave them and let the area get larger?
If you would like and have the room to do it that way, you could go ahead and do it. And it sounds like your tree is trying to reestablish itself. And so if you can allow it to do that, that actually is not a bad thing.
Okay.
But you might not like exactly where it's sending them up.
That's the problem. And I guess I wouldn't cut down every one of those large...
No, we generally recommend removing a third at a time.
So once a year, take out a third.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Right.
Thanks a lot for calling. Mark in New London, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks for calling.
Say, about 5 years ago, we had an opportunity to buy a lot in a Christmas tree farm. And now what I've been trying to do is I've been trying to plant seedlings every year to replenish the trees that we're taking off for our friends and our church and so forth. And I'm only having a success of less than 50% of the trees making it after a year or two. And I've been buying trees from a nursery out in Pennsylvania, balsam trees, and they're supposed to be about 2 to 3 years old.
Okay.
Is that a normal success rate, or should I maybe be trying to buy these trees from somebody in Wisconsin where it's more native soil? I have very sandy soil where I live. I'm on the south side of New London.
Okay. We like to buy trees locally. I mean, that's what we generally will recommend. And it's not just because we're, you know, go Wisconsin and support Wisconsin agriculture,
right,
which is important. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
Right.
But there's a good reason for buying locally, especially when you're trying to establish trees that are more of a native kind of tree, you know, more of a natural, a tree that's good for our environment, not an introduced species or anything like that. And the reason is that they are grown in a similar type of soil, a similar type of a climate, and it makes them adapt a little bit better. Now, you can plant trees from other places. You know, Monrovian Nursery sells trees all over the United States and Canada, and people can buy those and transplant them with great success. But the difference is that with a lot of our landscape trees, people will take great pains to make sure that those plants are properly cared for. And so the first 2 to 3 years of a tree's life in the landscape is really critical, and there is a lot of work that needs to go into those trees to make sure that they get established successfully, because 50% loss of trees that are transplanted is not really that unusual in an area where maybe you can't provide as much care as you could if you were putting them in your front yard. And watering, for example, is so critical. You know, and if we don't get rain every week, especially with a sandy soil, you know, if you're not getting 1 to 2 inches of rain every week and you're not watering those plants 1 to 2 inches of water every week, you're going to lose plants.
That's what I was wondering. I was wondering how much water a young balsam tree can handle, because I didn't want to overwater them. And, of course, we've had a couple of really dry summers, and with the soil being so sandy, it really gets dry quickly by our place.
Well, you know, there are two huge reasons that newly transplanted trees die. One is from underwatering, and one is from overwatering.
You know? Okay.
And so there is a balance, and there is a lot to be said for understanding your soil type and just keeping an eye on the weather. Because if we're having a drought, if we're having hot, dry weather, if we're having a lot of wind, all of those things contribute to excessive water loss. If you have a really sandy soil, you're going to have to water more. It's unlikely that with a really sandy soil that you would overwater those plants. But definitely a possibility that they could be underwatered. You know, the other reason that trees die is people plant them too deeply. And so, you know, it's really important that you're following proper tree planting advice and making sure they're getting planted at the proper depth. You know, we don't recommend, amending the soil for trees. We don't recommend fertilizer. You know, so you're looking at a process that's really pretty straightforward. You plant the tree at the right depth, at the right location, where it's getting enough sun, or in some cases a little bit of shade, depending on the type of tree, and then you make sure you water it. And that's pretty much it.
Okay.
And with a sandy soil, you know, it's unlikely that you could water it too much.
All right.
And you should be able to get, 100 3-year-old balsam firs for, $150 or so?
Is there a website that I could go to that might give me a listing of the different nurseries that'd be available in Wisconsin to buy them? Because I'd prefer to do that. I just been using this one because I found out about it. And
try the Christmas tree. What is the Wisconsin Christmas Tree Organization? Wisconsin, what is that website?
Christmas Tree Growers Association.
ChristmasTreeGrowers.org or Wisconsin. You could probably just Google Wisconsin Christmas Tree Growers Organization or Association.
Okay.
And get on their website, and they have a listing of all of the nurseries in our area that sell conifers.
Yeah, I know Jung's does, but there are others too.
Yeah.
There are. Okay.
Sure.
Great. Thanks for your help.
Yep. Thanks
Good
a
luck.
Lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Patty Nagai is our guest today, having lots of fun on this edition of Garden Talk. Patty's from Sturtevant, Wisconsin, home with her twins, but Grandma's there, too, to watch while she talks on the phone, which is a good thing. And she'll be with us right up till 12:30 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patty Nagai, horticulture educator for Racine County UW Extension. If you have a question, you're welcome to join in. Our lines are all filled right now, but here's the number, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, 263-1890. Virgil in Gilman, it's your turn now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Yes, I got a question here. Now, last fall we planted, or summer, we planted some apple trees, and they're doing fairly well. Not growing like they should, but what can I do to stop all these little flies clinging to the ends of the branches, which is a fruit fly, I believe?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what kind of little insect it is that's doing it. Are they doing some damage to the tree, or are they just annoying you?
They're just bugging me.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure exactly what the insect is that is doing that. You know, there are a lot of insects, of course, that are attracted to apple trees. Most of them are harmful, and we have lots of advice on how to control those various insects. But a little fly that's just, you know, I'm not sure what they're attracted to and what the appeal of the apple tree is, and so I'm not sure what to tell you on how to get rid of them. You know, there are a lot of non-environmentally harmful products like insecticidal soaps that could be used on your apple tree without any problem at all. Spray of water might actually help just to spray the trees off. The insecticidal soap might help with that. But I haven't ever heard of this before. So, Larry,
no.
Do you have a suggestion?
Well, one thing you could do is if you, Virgil, is to grab some of those insects and take them into the UW Extension office, your county extension office, and if they can't identify them, they'll send them on to Phil Pelletieri.
He'll be able to tell you everything about them.
Yes, he will. So which county are you in, Virgil? I'm sorry?
It looks just like a little fly, just like a little house fly. That's what it looks like.
Well, I'll tell you what, there are a lot of insects that look just like little houseflies, and I'll bet you your county extension horticulture educator can answer that for you.
Yeah, we would like to see it. What county are you in?
Taylor
County. I don't think there's a horticulture educator there, but there's an ag educator there, an ag agent, and so you
right.
could take a sample in it and let them get a positive ID on it, and maybe then they can come up with a more...
educated.
Something a little more educated than my random guess at trying to use insecticidal soap or just water to discourage them from landing on the trees. Because I haven't heard of this before, so this is a new thing for me.
Good luck, Virgil. Thank you very much for calling. Don in Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Don.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great, thanks for calling.
I was going to call you up for one thing, but listening to you, I got two things.
Okay.
Okay, the woman had problems with her rabbits and stuff eating up her garden.
Yep.
Well, I bought one of these books off of TV that's got all these remedies for doing this and doing that. And it says, get oil of peppermint. Well, I looked for oil of peppermint, but I couldn't find it, but I got peppermint oil. And it's supposed to be 100% pure.
Mm-hmm.
They've got stuff. They've got like 3-4 different things in the health food stores, extracts, this and that. But you got to get the 100% pure peppermint oil. Well, I've got turkeys, I got rabbits, I got gophers, I got everything else.
Did it work?
I put a pile of corn, sunflower seeds, everything I could think of. And you're supposed to take cotton balls and put a couple drops of this peppermint oil on it. So I took 3 cotton balls and dripped some oil on that. The gophers left town. The squirrels, they come up to it, and they backed up. I've got gray squirrels and a couple of black squirrels. They'd run up, grab a piece, and go the other way. I'm looking out my back window. I live out in the country. There's a rabbit coming. I'm watching him from 100 feet away or better. He's running up there. At about 20 feet, he turned around and went the other way.
That's funny.
So
that's a, and you know what? Peppermint oil would smell a whole lot better than rotten eggs.
Yeah, sure would.
It's like $4 for a $4 for a 1-ounce bottle, but
yeah. Well, you probably don't need a whole lot of it, though.
No, and you just put a few drops on it.
And you know, there are other things like that out there. You know, you can buy also pure garlic oil,
yeah,
which repels a lot of animals are repelled by garlic oil. But with any repellent, you are going to have to replace the repellent frequently, and you might have to switch off with another repellent.
Right, because
so
I think they get used to
they
it
get
after
used to
a while.
It. Mm-hmm. And so
I even took these little cotton balls and took them some tacks and put them on the bottom side of the bird feeders.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that kept squirrels off of there for a while, but after a while they get used to it.
Yeah, and then they decide they like the flavor and
taste
of the peppermint.
No. Well, anyway,
look, he's flavored our corn with peppermint oil. How nice of him.
When it comes to deer, I used to feed the deer, and then the DNR says you can't feed the deer this and
right.
that. Well, I got apple trees in the garden and all that stuff. I don't think there's nothing going to keep the deer out of your garden except the fence that you talked about.
Yep, the very tall fence.
I went outside and I jumped up and down on my deck. I got bottle rockets and shot them. I had a plastic tube where I'd aim them horizontally, and I had them exploding a couple of feet over their backs, and he'd back up a couple of feet and look at you, turn around and keep eating. So as far as deer goes, you might as well forget it.
Yep.
If you don't have a fence, they're going to eat it.
Or a dog.
A fence and a dog is probably the best combination.
Yeah, if you got both a fence and a dog, you should not.
You should be good. Yeah.
You should be good. Thanks, Don. Thanks a lot for calling. I like that story about the peppermint. That's for sure.
I'm going to have to try that now. I've got garlic oil to try this year for the first time, so I'm going to try the garlic oil and see if that works with the rabbits. But I'm not hopeful.
Marilyn in South Range, your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, and thank you so much. First of all, we have a little American Eskimo that keeps at our rural home the deer running and jumping into the woods again.
Okay.
If they get close.
See?
And so she just likes to be the one to take
it's
care of
it's her job.
But second of all, last year we did some remodeling on the siding. And I had to move all the irises that I have. I put them in a vegetable garden, and I think they're coming up fine again this year. But
okay.
I want to know, after they flower, how soon can I transplant them?
You can do it any time, but the best time to transplant iris is in the fall. You know, you want to wait until the foliage starts to die back a little bit.
Right.
So that's the best time to do it, but you can do it any time. You know, you can even do it while they're flowering if you really want to.
Yeah.
But it will probably affect your flowering. You know, the key to moving iris is to make sure that you've got a nice location for them. They're ready to go. You've got the soil amended like you need it amended, and that you don't plant them too deeply.
Right.
You know,
well, I know how to plant them.
Okay, good.
And it's kind of a dry area, which they seem to love.
Yeah. Well, some iris like dry, some like wet. It just depends on what kind you
have.
Yeah.
Well, I got them from a neighbor. I don't even know.
Are they Siberian iris or are they bearded iris?
I'm not sure. They're purple and white.
Okay, a lot of them are purple.
Yeah.
And they're not the real...
Are they a small flower? With a very narrow, strappy leaf?
They're about 2 or 3 inches. They grow, you know, they grow up the side, but...
Are the leaves very grass-like as opposed to being really flat? I bet it's a Siberian iris. And the Siberian are very tolerant of a lot of different types of conditions. They can handle really moist, but they can also handle pretty dry. They do fine even in heavy clay soil. But they prefer a nice, rich, organic, well-drained soil.
Mm-hmm.
I have transplanted them. You know, they are so tough. I have had some that I got from a friend in St. Louis and kept in a plastic bag on the back of my house for a year. No kidding. I never planted them, and I've forgotten about them, and I went out there, and they were still alive.
Oh, boy.
And I planted them, and they did fine.
That might be good for the ones that I had in the box covered up in the garage, and even though we've had cold weather, they still had some green on them this
spring.
Plant
them.
So
they'll be fine.
I'm trying to plant them again.
And, you know, the thing about the Siberians is that once they get established in an area, they are actually very difficult to transplant because they develop a very tough root system that you will need an axe to cut through.
Well, then I don't know if that's the type, because these I you know, divide it every 3 or 4 years.
And they're doing okay.
They divide up well. And,
well, it might not be a Siberian then, but the way you described it, it kind of sounded like it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There are some great iris websites you can go online and try and figure out which one you have.
I have another quick question I thought about. We have an apple tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Herald Red, I think is what it is.
Okay.
And I didn't know anything about pruning when we first got it, and it grew maybe 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a fork in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we took one of the forks off, and the other one just kind of went down towards the ground again. So it's stopped at a certain height.
Okay.
Well, down about 2 feet off the ground, there's a long, slender shoot.
Coming up from the ground?
No, coming up from the plant.
Okay.
That's taller than the tree, and it's really too tall for the, you know, to pick the apples when we get it.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't a lot of branches on it. Do you think I could safely take that off, and would it be a good idea?
It would be a good idea because it's probably just a sucker. And, you know, there are a lot of pruning rules regarding apple trees, and if they're not pruned properly, you know, you don't get fruit production at all. So the pruning process for apples is really important if you want good fruit production. And we do have a really nice publication on how to train and prune apple trees that'll give you some guidelines on what to take off and what to leave. And that's on our publications website, that learningstore.uwex.edu, and you can just type in pruning apples. But basically for apples, what you want to remove any suckers that come up from the bottom of the plant, and you want to remove any crossing branches, and you want to remove what are called water sprouts. And those are the branches that come from, they're like straight shoots that come up from the branches of the tree, and they grow straight up like suckers, but they're coming from the tree itself. And those should all be removed as well. And you need to, you know, for an apple tree, you need to provide a branching structure that will support flowers and fruit and allow enough light to get down into the center of the tree to really get good fruit production. So if you want it for fruit production, it's really important that it's pruned correctly.
So good luck, and thanks very much, Marilyn.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Kay and Slinger, it's your turn now. Hi, Kay. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm calling to let people know about Friends of Lac La Ranne's 20th wildflower sale.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be Saturday, May 12th from 9 until 1 p.m., and we sell wildflowers, which are woodland, prairie, and wetland varieties. We have coneflowers, black-eyed Susans, just a variety of plants and trees. And we'd love people to come out and take a look. It is a fundraiser. We're going to be building a nature center in the conservancy area. And it's just real exciting because we are getting started this year to do a little more of the building. And it'd be great for people to get plants that are native plants. These are from our area. We've planted a lot right on the farm, and we repot those for the wildflower sale. They're 1 and 2 year growth, so they're nice, hardy plants. And I just wanted to make that available to people.
And sure, where is it again? And it's May 12th, right?
Correct. It's at Lac La Ranne Conservancy, and the address is 300 Schmidt Road in West Bend.
300 Schmidt Road, West Bend.
Correct, and it's east of the courthouse.
Thank you very much, Kay.
Thank you.
Yep, appreciate the call.
Excellent. Lots of good plant sales going on this time of year.
Oh, absolutely. And Dave in New Glarus, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you? Great program.
Thank you.
We live out in the country, but our house is up on top of a hill, and we're lucky if we have like 2 inches of dirt for the grass to grow. But we would like to get some garden up here closer to the house.
Okay.
And we were thinking about, you know, maybe a dump truck size amount of dirt, maybe a garden area that might be 15 by 15 feet, not necessarily solid, you know, broken up or something. But how do we go about finding out what kind of soil we might be able to get that could be useful for growing garden in?
And, okay. Well, you know,
and information in general.
Are you looking for a really large garden? Are you looking for some more decorative kinds of gardens?
Or no, we're vegetable garden.
Vegetable garden.
Well, you know, one of the things that we do in a lot of areas in the urban area when, you know, the soil may not be the greatest is we do raised bed gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And they're easy to construct. You can do a simple 4 by 16 foot raised bed using timber and just L brackets and screws on the corners. It's really simple to build. And just fill it. And what we use, instead of using topsoil, we actually use compost. And we've been really fortunate to have a good supply of very good quality compost through our local waste management facility.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can call around and find some good quality compost, I would recommend going with compost rather than just a topsoil.
Mm-hmm.
But what you'll find is that a lot of companies will sell you also a blend of topsoil and compost. It might be 70-30, it might be 50-50. And again, I would go with something like that rather than just topsoil.
Okay.
Whenever you bring in topsoil, and you know, there are all different quality levels of topsoil, but inevitably, it's going to be contaminated with weed seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the topsoil is not any better than what you already have.
No, yeah. I have nothing almost.
But compost, you know, if you can find a good source for compost where you live, compost is always a good amendment for any kind of soil, whether you have a sandy soil or a clay soil or a rocky soil or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Compost is always a good amendment, and we use it in our community gardens in the raised beds without any additional soil at all. We actually build the raised beds with these 2x10s and fill it completely with compost.
Okay.
And compost doesn't, you know, if it's good quality, you're not going to have any weeds because the weed seeds will have been killed.
How deep is this going to have to be for, like, tomatoes and beans and stuff?
Well, our raised beds are only 10 inches.
Okay.
And most of the area where we built the raised beds, we did till the soil up before we built the raised beds. But you don't actually have to do that because roots are really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did was we built the raised beds. They just sit right on the ground. We put down about 12 to 15 layers of newspaper,
mm-hmm.
which helps block any weeds that might be in the natural soil. Fill the thing with compost and then plant directly in the compost. And, you know, watering is very critical when you're using a raised bed because they warm up faster and they dry out faster.
Mm-hmm.
So you do want to make sure that you keep it nice and watered. But if you can get that compost in there, you won't have as many weed problems. And the plants they'll grow in that top 10 inches of compost for sure, but they are going through the newspaper. They're going into the natural soil, you know, because tomato roots can go good 3 feet, 4 feet deep, no problem.
My natural soil here is mostly limestone rock.
Yeah. Well, you might want to make yours a little bit deeper.
Yeah.
Are there any publications available on this?
You know, we've just sort of been winging it down here in Racine. But you know, there are some nice publications out there, not necessarily extension, although there are some extension publications. You could do a search on raised bed gardening and square foot gardening, and both of those will probably yield some designs for raised beds
mm-hmm.
that you can construct pretty easily. You can also use other things. In my own yard, I used stone and built my raised beds out of stone, and they're about 12 inches deep.
Okay.
But you can use cinder block, You can use all sorts of materials.
There are even some. You can buy kits, raised garden bed kits that use cedar, for example,
right.
as
and,
a wood.
And even the plastic that looks like wood,
mm-hmm.
they have a lot of kits made out of that as well that you can build the raised beds out of. So there are lots of options out there. But there are also a lot of nice professional publications out there on how to do raised bed gardening.
Okay, and the other term you used was square foot gardening?
Square foot gardening. And the reason I said square foot gardening is it is one of the intensive gardening methods that utilizes raised beds.
Okay.
And so the square foot gardening publications, there's also one called postage stamp gardening, and there are French intensive gardening books, and mm-hmm. lots of these types of garden books that will have many different designs for raised beds and ideas on how to get more out of your space.
John okay. John Jevons has a book on raised bed gardening, Jeavins. John Jevons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Another possibility for you, but there's a lot of information out there on it.
Lots and lots of information. And if you go on our website, on the Extension Publications website, we do have some small publications on specialized gardening techniques, container gardening, a few things like that. But I don't know that we have anything really specific on how to build a raised bed.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. Good luck. Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot.
You bet.
Great question.
Rita in Milwaukee. Hi to you.
Hi. My question is now a good time to attack garlic mustard?
Yes.
And what, again, a second. And what do I use?
Well, there are a number of different methods, and there's a lot of good information out there on different techniques for controlling garlic mustard. We have a brochure on controlling garlic mustard, and it's available on the Extension website. There's also a DNR one-page fact sheet available on getting rid of garlic mustard. All of the Extension offices have information on how to get rid of it. Garlic mustard, of course, for those who aren't familiar with it, it is a European introduction that is destroying our woodland areas. And it grows at the edge of the woodland in an area where a lot of our native wildflowers grow. And within 2 years of its establishment or introduction into an area, it can completely take over the area and kill out native wildflowers like Jack in the Pulpit and Virginia Waterleaf and a lot of these other wildflowers, trilliums, yeah. and things like that. So to get rid of it, it's a biennial. So the first year it comes up and it makes a nice little green rosette kind of plant. The leaves can be 2 inches across.
Got about 30 seconds.
Okay. And the second year it flowers, and then it dies. So pulling is still a good recommendation for getting rid of it. You need to get the flowers out, though, before they set seed, and they need to go in the garbage. Do not compost them. Do not leave them lie in the woodland area because they will continue to make seed. So you need to get them out. There are some sprays you can use. They are responsive to any kind of broadleaf weed killer or to a compound containing glyphosate. But you have to be careful about using herbicides in the woodland area.
Patty, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Great show. Lots of questions.
Lots of great questions. Patty Nagai, horticulture educator for Racine County UW Extension. We'll have her back, and we will do this again with her. And, of course, next week we'll have another edition of Garden Talk. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.